Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 266, and we're going to talk about water everywhere, and hopefully you have a drop to drink, but you may also have more than just one type of water. We're also going to talk about truck rot. Yeah, that's a tale from the road. That's going to be a lot of fun for me. A place to visit that James Bond's boss once ate at. And a product review of a Camco drain, because that's a very exciting thing. But we actually do need to talk about it because it's important. And yeah, anyway, hi, welcome back. I'm glad to be here with you. I am going to talk a lot about water, because water is very important, and I don't think enough people talk about water in van life, and I think we should, so we're going to, just like this, like right now. So here's the deal. Water's a resource, and I don't mean in a global sense. I mean in a van sense. Water is one of the primary resources that is a problem for van life. I mean, people talk about gas and gas mileage all the time, sure. We talk endlessly about solar and generators and batteries and power. Power's good. Power's important. But water is the thing that, for me, is my personal limiter on how long I can stay out without some sort of support. Of all the things, power, gasoline, diesel, all the stuff I can run out of. Food, got to throw food in there too. Water is the thing I run out of first. And I think we need to spend some time looking at that. Now, over the years, I've had many different rigs with many, many different water systems. I once had an RV that had a 100-gallon water tank. The Airstream has a, I think, 55-gallon water tank. The Winnebago I have has a 40-gallon water tank. And the new truck camper, which you're going to hear a lot about, has a 9-gallon water tank, which, while it sounds small, my van has a 6-gallon water tank, and my previous van had a 5-gallon water tank. I was able to stay out for 2 weeks without any water support in my little van, even with just a 5-gallon tank. And I'm going to tell you how I did that. But I'm also going to tell you how you should think about water as a resource, and why I said in the intro that there's more than one kind of water. Or let's get to the basics. You need water for basically two things. You need water for drinking, hydration, cooking, and you need water for cleaning. Washing dishes, washing yourself, washing whatever else needs to be washed. And those are two different kinds of water. Because the water you ingest has to be pure. It has to be free of pathogens and toxins and stuff. It has to be like tap water, or it has to be like bottled water. But the other water, well, it doesn't need to be anywhere near as pure. And while we grow up in houses or apartments usually, and we're used to water coming out of the tap, and we use that same water for drinking and for washing, depending on where you live, we probably shouldn't do that in vans, because drinking water is a lot more valuable and a lot harder to come by than washing water. And so for me, I, in all of my rigs now, have used the two-tank system, and I think this is hugely beneficial. Basically, I have a tank that is just for drinking water, just for cooking. Now, there are some exceptions to that I'll get into, but in general, if I'm going to drink something or if I'm going to cook something that uses water, like let's say I'm making soup and I need a can of water for the soup, that will come from the pure drinking water system that I have. And that system isn't a system, it's a jug. Mostly it's been a gallon milk jug type of jug. And the water that's in there isn't necessarily water that I bought. It's water that I knew absolutely 100% was pure when it went in there. It's also water that does not sit. Once that has been opened, it has a shelf life, and I don't let it just sit there. If it's been open for more than a week, I dump it. If it's unopened, if it's water that I bought that's unopened, basically, I will let that sit longer, because obviously it's sitting on the shelf in the store. There's not much difference between it in the store and in my van other than temperature. Couple of things about that. I actually worked in a water bottling plant in Utah for a single day. That was enough. And I watched how they filled, you know, the spring water that is sold on the stores, on the shelves in Utah supermarkets, and it comes out of a tap. Now, I don't know what that tap's connected to. It very well could be connected to a spring, but there's no purification process anywhere. The water comes out of the tap, goes into the jug, and then the caps are put on by a machine. But the machine wasn't very good, and it would miss maybe one out of every nine bottles. And there was just a bucket of water with caps in it, and you would just reach your hand in there, grab the cap, and slap it on the bottle. So this is not sterile water by any means. It is safe to drink, and I'm not exactly sure how true that is. But no, it is. It is. I trust it. I have never had a problem with any kind of bottled water. With one exception, this is a thing that can happen, and I'm getting too deep here, but I just don't know when else to put this in here. If you have a gallon bottle of water that hasn't been opened, and it freezes, bottles are designed in such a way that they won't burst usually. There's this divot in it that will expand as the water expands, and that prevents it from bursting, which is a good thing. However, that water is going to be different. If you take a gallon of spring water and freeze it, and then you drink it, it will taste different, and it will leave sediment. Because in that water is dissolved minerals. This is not pure H2O. This is H2O with whatever minerals are in the water source in it. Calcium, usually, lots of calcium, maybe a little bit of lithium, maybe some salts, things like that. And when it freezes, the water becomes pure. The water freezes itself and pushes out all those impurities. I'm using that word, but this stuff isn't harmful. It's just not water. And it precipitates, it comes out. And I've noticed this year in the Airstream, we had 6 water bottles freeze last year, which is not a big deal, it's fine. But they all have sediment in them. And when I make coffee in the coffee maker, there's sediment left behind. So I just want to throw that out there. It's not a bad thing, it's just something that's, why is there this dusty stuff? Well, that's why. Okay. So obviously that covers your drinking and cooking. You just use that type of water, either from a known good faucet or you bought it or whatever. But what about your other system? This is the tricky part. In general, you're going to use more water washing than you are for your own personal drinking and cooking. So that system needs to be bigger. But it also doesn't need to be potable or drinkable. You have probably been somewhere where you've seen a sink that says non-potable water, and that sink is probably there to wash your hands. So it's actually fine. You can get things on your skin that won't hurt you that if you drank would hurt you. So that's what I do, basically. I have a big tank, and I try to put as good water in there as possible. I'll use tap water if that's possible. But if not, I've used rainwater. I've used water from a stream once. And I'm okay with that because what I'm using that water for, that's all fine. I mean, heck, folks, you'll swim in a pond. You can wash with water in a pond, too. In fact, as a kid, we used to go to this cabin. It was called Kingston Lakes Cabins, I think. It was up in New Hampshire. And there was no bathing in the cabins. And we would literally take a bar of Ivory soap and head down into the pond and wash up in the pond. Or the lake. I guess it was technically a lake, although it wasn't a big one. And why did we use Ivory soap? If you're my age, you know. It's because Ivory soap floats. All the other soap sinks, and if you dropped it in the pond, it would be gone forever. Anyway, it's fine. It's fine. You do not have to bathe in perfectly clean water. And that's the way I handle it. You have the expensive water, if you want to look at it that way, and the cheap water. Now, you don't want to put the grossest, grimiest water in your tank. I mean, your tanks will get funky in time. And because of that, I also recommend you treat that water with bleach. Plain old, over-the-counter bleach. Because it's a really inexpensive and effective water purifier. And it won't do anything for toxins, which are less of a problem than bacteria. But it'll take out the bacteria. Usually, the amount to treat the water, it's surprisingly little. It's half a teaspoon per 5 gallons. It's not much. I overkill it a little bit because the water can be warm because it sits in a van. And if it smells a little bit like bleach, I don't care. You know, this isn't drinking water. This is just water I'm washing with. So, yeah, half a teaspoon per 5 gallons. But I say a capful per 5 gallons. That's how I measure it. That's more than enough. And if you were to drink that water, yeah, there would be a bleachy taste, but that's not what it's for. However, if you had to drink it in an emergency, you could. It would be purified. So that's how I handle that. Back to when I was using that van and getting a whole week out of 5 gallons of water, basically how I did that was I didn't clean anything. And by that I mean I cleaned myself with all different manner of wet wipes and alcohol and things like that. I used dry shampoo spray, which is a thing. It's basically a cornstarch that comes in an aerosol can, and you spray it in your hair, and then you comb it out. And the cornstarch absorbs the oil, and you comb it out. It doesn't really clean your hair, but it at least makes it less oily, which is the big problem. And it smells better, I guess. And I only use the water very briefly for things like, well, I brushed my teeth with it, and I would do little tiny bits of cleaning, but I use paper plates, and then I used plastic forks and knives, which you can complain about, but I also washed them frequently. That was a big, easy thing to do. And that's basically how I got away with it. I just didn't use water. And as for my personal hydration, I was keeping hydrated with other fluids that I had with me in the fridge. You know, I had Gatorade, I had some soda, and things like that. And so that's how I handled it. And yeah, 2 weeks was fine. After 2 weeks, I was completely out of water, and I had to come back. And I ended up getting, on that particular trip that I'm thinking of, I ended up getting water at the supermarket for like 39 cents a gallon. I actually just took my 5-gallon jug into the supermarket and filled it up, and that was not the biggest deal in the world. So, it's doable. It's doable. Water's a resource, and you can be very stingy with it and last a long time. Was I the cleanest person in the world after those 2 weeks? No. I was acceptable. I was also traveling alone, so my level of acceptable was a rather personal level, so that was fine. But I just am pointing out that you really don't have to go crazy with water. When my wife does the dishes in the Airstream, it's funny because she treats it just like we're at home. So she just lets the faucet run, and she's like rinsing the dishes with the faucets running. And I'm like, ah, and I bite my tongue because it doesn't really matter because we can get all the water we want. But to my van life brain, I'm just like, no, you know, so I have strategies for doing dishes and things that use less water. For example, I use one of those Powered On spray dish soap dispenser things, and I will put all the dishes in the sink. If you have a sink, if you don't have a sink, you have a bowl or a bucket, whatever. I put all the dishes in there with soap and a bit of water, and then I scrub them all and then just put them back in the bucket. So what I end up with is this bucket of soapy, dirty water with all these utensils and whatever else I'm washing in there. And then I rinse them into that same bucket. So I'm basically rinsing the water, and it goes back into that same bucket, which helps rinse the things that are already in there. And the way I rinse isn't one item at a time. For example, I'll gather all the silverware, hold it in my fist, and then spray that. That washes off all the soap, and then it's good to go. Plates I have to do one at a time. But I basically, the entire time I'm thinking, how can I do this with as little water as possible? And then the last step, which is actually very helpful when you're using little water, is I always dry the dishes. I don't let them air dry. I use a cloth and dry them. That takes off any remaining residue as well. Now, there's a big debate. In the UK, apparently, they do not rinse dishes after they wash them with fairy liquid, which I actually saw in Scotland when I was just there. I think that's interesting. I do want to rinse the soap off my dishes. They don't, and that's just an interesting thing. But I also think they dry their dishes with a cloth, and that cloth takes off the excess soap, whereas in the U.S. we often will put them in a rack and let them dry. Anyway, doesn't matter. I do need to mention a couple other things about water, though, that are very important. First is there are some things you should never, ever take any risks with water about at all, ever. Those two things are CPAPs and neti pots, or any kind of nasal lavage. And the reason is a little weird. There's this amoeba that is very common. It lives in the soil, it lives in water. And if it gets into your nasal passages, it can actually get into your brain and kill you, which is not a small thing. And people have been killed by using impure water in their CPAPs and in neti pots, or even by swimming in ponds and like going upside down and getting water up their nose. So it's a rare thing, but it's not something you ever, ever want to mess with. My advice for CPAP users is, if you can, try to learn to use the CPAP without heat or moisture. That is the most compatible way of using CPAPs with van life. For me, that was easy. I hate the moisture. As soon as I tried a CPAP with the moisture, I was like, someone's breathing hot air in my nose. I hated it. Other people absolutely need it, so you'll have to make that balance there. A lot of these small portable CPAPs have a different way of doing moisture where you don't have to fill a water tank, so you look at that too. And as for neti pots, absolutely only ever, ever use the most pure water you possibly can. I would recommend boiling it first as well, because you are directly introducing water into your nasal passages, where if there were some of those amoebas in there, they would just go to town. So there are some exceptions. Also, and I will personally mention these exceptions, I'm not sure these are good ideas, but I'm going to mention that this is what I do. You will make your own decisions. I am okay with using the secondary washing water for things like boiling pasta, because it's just so much water. I think about it, and I'm like, this water is going to be boiling for a good long time. That should sterilize anything in there. For the most part, I'm not putting really filthy, dirty water in there. It's okay water, and it's been treated with bleach. The boiling gets rid of the bleach, like, very quickly. Bleach vaporizes in very low, relatively low temperatures, so that's not even an issue. And I also brush my teeth with it, and which is, you know, maybe the riskier thing, but it's not that much water. There's a little tiny bit, and it's all mixed in with the toothpaste. It's just easier. Now, whether you should do those or not, you will have to decide for yourself. The last bit about water, I do have a life straw with me. I bring a life straw with me. I've never had to use it. If you're not familiar with these, a life straw is a straw that has an amazing filter system in it, and you can literally stick one of these things in a mud puddle and suck through it, and the water will be drinkable. Now, they're not the end-all, be-all. You can't filter your own urine, for example. You're not going to be able to filter some really nasty chemicals out. Like, if you spilled gasoline in a bucket of water, don't use your life straw there. It's not going to help you. But for things like pond water, river water, water that is kind of looks clear, yeah, this thing will get rid of Giardia spores and all kinds of bacteria and things like that. And you can get, it's a safe source for emergency water. Now, the ones I have are very inexpensive. You just use them like a straw. You can put them in, you know, you can like get a glass of water and then use the straw to suck the water out of the glass, just for emergencies in my case. They do make bag systems where you can fill a bag and the water will drip through one of these filters and then you have good water. I've never had to deal with that, but it doesn't sound like a terrible idea. I've just never had to get there because all my other methods work well. So there's a lot more to say about water. I didn't even touch on where you can get water. There's a secret tip I will give you, though. If you can't find water anywhere, find a cemetery, because cemeteries almost always have water. Whether that water is potable or not, you're not really sure, so I would recommend that being a secondary source of water. But cemeteries almost always have water that's publicly available. Water is important. Think of it like a resource. Remember that water is heavy, and that's why you don't fill up your 100-gallon tank, because 100 gallons of water weighs about 850 pounds. It's too much, and that's another big part of the equation. And special thanks to Frederic, who bought me a gallon this week at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. This week, what he bought me was a gallon of coffee. I've been drinking so much coffee lately, and thank you, Frederic, for that. If you would like to help support the show and keep ads off of the show, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And join Frederic and others who donate every month in helping to keep ads far, far away. I thank you all, as do all the listeners. Van Life News. Well, the rhyming duo of Darren and Karen are back, and they have presented us with some news for this week, and I'm just going to present what they've given us. In fact, I'm going to read it with you, because I have not looked at this stuff yet, other than as a glance. I'm trusting them, because they have proven themselves trustworthy. First news is from, let's see, it's from the Associated Press, and it is San Francisco to ban homeless people from living in RVs with new parking limits. Yeah, San Francisco, that's the headline, but wait till you hear the real story. San Francisco is having a parking limit in the entire city of 2 hours for RVs. 2 hours. So, yeah, if you want to drive your van to San Francisco and, like, go do something, you've got to do it in 2 hours. Like, that's not even enough to see a movie. And the limit isn't based on RVs necessarily, it's on the size of the vehicle. So 22 feet is the limit. That means my Sprinter would have just come on under that. But the worst part is the height. So it's 22 feet long and 7 feet high, which is 2 meters. My pickup truck barely fits under that, and with the camper on it, it absolutely does not. My van, not even close. My NV200, yeah, it would have been under that. So my NV200 would have fit. But most of you guys with the you know, the sizable vans and trucks, basically you're going to be limited to parking for only 2 hours in San Francisco. Now, if you happen to live in San Francisco, you can apply for a permit for 6 months. So they're not being entirely cruel, but during that 6 months, you have to agree to counseling and to accept offers for alternate housing, and the city has the right to buy your RV from you for the whopping price of $175 per foot. How much is your vehicle worth? It's like, well, last week it was worth, 22 times $175, but I put a hitch on it and a rack, and I think I can get another $175 out of them for that. It's all kind of insanity. I mean, obviously San Francisco has to fix this terrible problems they have, but who's being punished here? It's always the people with the least resources, you know? And anyway... Yeah, link in the show notes if you want to read more about that. In a more positive note, Toyota is working on a new minivan that's based on like its Land Cruiser, so like an off-road minivan. Now, this is called the X-Van Gear Concept, and it looks very cool, but this is just a prototype. It's just an idea, and chances are it'll never make it to the U.S. But for the rest of you, I mean, isn't this what a lot of us want? An affordable, rugged van that has a lot of space in it. And looking at the pictures, it kind of looks like a rugged Honda Element. Although, apparently, it is mostly related to the Land Cruiser chassis, not the old one. Toyota recently changed the Land Cruiser from being a fairly beefy, expensive vehicle to a much lighter, cheaper vehicle. And I haven't actually seen one on the road yet. But anyway, they're suggesting that this will start selling for about $23,500, which sounds wonderful. But again, it's just a concept. But you'll see, if you look at the news article, I'll have links in the show notes, it looks wonderful. It's got really interesting doors. So on the side, it has two doors. They're both sliders, but one of them is the door the driver would normally get in. So imagine that being a slider, and the door slides out past the hood. And then the other slider, which would be, quote, a normal slider, slides all the way back. And there is no B pillar. You just have a giant opening, and holy cow, this thing has lots of potential. So it's very exciting. Again, it's not real yet. And then again, it will probably never make it to the U.S. because we are not allowed to have nice things. Darn you, chicken techs. Okay, in battery news, because it's, you know, been a couple minutes, we have to talk about batteries because that's the way it is. But anyway, this is actually good news, I hope. General Motors says that its new LMR battery will deliver major cost savings. This is from InsideEVs.com, obviously an EV publication. LMR stands for lithium manganese rich, which is a chemistry that doesn't need some of the nasty chemicals that lithium does, like cobalt. Cobalt is difficult to mine, it makes a big mess, and it's expensive. And if you can reduce the amount of cobalt, not only will the batteries cost less, they'll be much more environmentally friendly. And GM is investing in this technology and is starting to produce them with a partner, LG, which stands for Lucky Gold Star, believe it or not, in 2027. Hopefully, we will see that. And they're estimating 400 miles of range, which is similar to their current NMCA batteries, nickel, manganese, cobalt, aluminum batteries. Anyway, this is all good. When we have a rapid innovation cycle like we do right now in batteries, we're going to see a lot of things like this, and I hope this continues. The government seems to be trying to tamp down any advances in EV, but money is always going to talk, and if we can get cheaper batteries that can produce enough power that are not subject to the whims of the oil market like gasoline is. I mean, sure, you pay $3 a gallon today, it could be $5 a gallon tomorrow, you don't know. Yes, sorry, Europeans, I know those sound like bargain prices to you. These innovations will keep happening, and I am all about it. And, well, something we probably already knew. This is from ABC13.com, which is apparently in Houston, Texas. Houston business owner says work vans are sitting ducks and being targeted by thieves for tools. Yeah, this is a real thing. So I don't even have to read the article to talk about this. But basically, this guy, like, in many places, he's got vans parked and, you know, people, they're work vans, so they stay at work overnight and people come and break in them during the night. When I was with Team Rubicon, we had that problem all the time. We had a big warehouse in, I'll just say, a part of Texas, not Houston. And yeah, at night people would come and just tear through those things. We had trailers too. They thought there were tools there because they would see us with the tools. Well, what they didn't know is we took them inside at night, but they would break into the vehicles, not find anything, and then they would cut off the catalytic converters, which of course is a big hassle. I remember one day we came in, we were about to tow a trailer a few thousand miles, and the truck, when we started, it made a funny noise. Someone looked under it, and this was a big 450, big dually pickup. Someone had gone under there, cut off the catalytic converter, and in doing so, cut the wiring harness and the frame of the truck. It cost so much money to replace that. It was ridiculous. So this is mostly of concern to the stealth people. You know, oh, just make your van look like a plumber's van and no one will think twice. Well, there are people who will think twice. They'll think, oh, there's tools in there. So I've had this conversation a lot with folks, actually. You know, is there such a thing as stealth? Doesn't stealth encourage people to think there are tools in your van? And the truth is that people are going to break into your van if they think they can get away with it and if they think there's something valuable in there. And what van doesn't meet that criteria? The answer is a minivan, by the way. But if you have a larger van, it's a target no matter what. So then from my perspective, what you want to do is have it be as little noticeable as possible. Stealth is not about invisibility, it's about ignorability. And on that, I recommend no decals, no words. Words are memorable. No words at all. Do not create a fake business and put it on the side. Just a plain white van, or even a plain colored van, it doesn't matter, with nothing that looks good inside. And my personal strategy from having a few of these vans and never having anyone break in, thankfully, even though I've lived in some questionable Chicago neighborhoods, is if you look through the front window, you will see just nothing that's of interest. I actually will purposely leave a fast food bag in plain sight and a high-vis vest. Those two things, to me, if I'm looking in there, I see those two things and I'm like, ah, there's nothing good in here. You can have your own opinions on that, and that's fine, and I'm not going to get into a big argument about it at all. This is all just a guess. It's a matter of being in the right place at the right time, or vice versa. I apparently have been lucky, but yeah, this happens. Well, thanks to the rhyming duo of Darren and Karen for the news. I will have links in the show notes. Tech Talk. Do you need a gray tank? And the reason I ask is because there's so many people who don't have one, and there's so many vehicles that don't come with one. My first RV that I bought was a Toyota Chinook, a great vehicle. I wish I still made them. Did not have a gray tank. It just had a little knob on the outside that you undid. It was a plug, and then water would come out the side. You're supposed to put a hose on that and have the water go into a bucket, but I didn't know that. Anyway, that was my first, so that was no gray tank. And then my Scamp, that is now Yogi's Scamp, also doesn't have a gray tank. Same situation, there's just a thing on the side. There's a longer story with that Scamp. It used to have a gray tank. It doesn't have it anymore because somebody did something crazy at one point before I got it. And then I told the story of how I tried to fix it and completely failed. Anyway, that one doesn't have a gray tank. And my new truck camper does not have a gray tank. It's the same. There's just this thing you unscrew and the water comes out there. So this is clearly a thing you can do because all these RVs come that way. And a lot of the prominent RVers don't even have sinks or anything. They, you know, Foresty Forest and Chrome, for example, do not have plumbing in their vehicles. They don't have sinks. They don't have faucets or any of that. They're making it work, and they're full-time. So how do they handle it? Well, they are dealing with their gray water on a daily basis, basically, or even at a moment's basis. What do you have gray water from? You have it from washing. So whatever they're doing to wash their dishes and such, they are finding a place to deal with that gray water immediately. And it may be that they're just dumping it in the woods, which, again, that is a controversial issue. My line is that it's the quantity that's the problem, and one guy in 300 acres of woods all by himself is not going to do a whole lot of damage. Yet, if everybody did that and there were 900 campers there, that, you know, you get it. Or they're collecting it and they're just not showing it on video, but I don't think they're doing that. So, the deal is, you are supposed to collect your gray water at campgrounds. And if you have one of these campers, you're supposed to let that water go into a bucket or some sort of a jug and then dispose of it in the sewer system or whatever. That's the what you're supposed to do. I do that when it's convenient, but when it's not convenient, I will just let it go on the ground. But again, I am conscious of where I'm doing that. For example, I have my own property that's basically a giant campground, and I have no problem letting that water just go on the ground. It doesn't bother me at all. It's, you know, it's not as bad as washing my car, I can tell you that. There's less soap, for example, that's going to get on the ground. There's nothing nasty in there. I am fine with it. But I am careful not to let it go into this giant culvert I have. Just have to explain a little bit. This property has a giant drainage culvert that basically catches all the water that comes down the hill before it hits the site that I'm using for camping. It's this concrete trough, basically, and the water goes in there, and that leads to a pipe that dumps straight into the river. When I'm dumping gray water, it is nowhere near that. I want that gray water to be filtered by plants and the ground and stuff before it gets anywhere else. Now, again, this is such a small quantity of water that for the Illinois River, which has all kinds of other stuff in it, it probably wouldn't matter. But it matters to me, and I am going to make that little effort. Now, in places where I do need to worry about gray water, I just carry a bucket. And what I actually use is one of those 5-gallon collapsible containers. Mine happens to be blue. They're often blue. Sometimes they're white. And the reason I do this is because when I'm not using it for that, it doesn't take up as much space. And then I run a hose from that into that, and then I can watch and see how quickly it fills up. And then I will dispose of that in a safe manner. And it's not that big of a deal. The biggest problem is that when you are in transit and you're driving somewhere and you pull over and you want to like wash your hands or do dishes, where does that water go? And well, the answer is it doesn't go anywhere. It'll just stay in the plumbing, and that's kind of a pain in the butt. So what I'm hoping to do with the truck camper is I'm hoping to have kind of a gray tank that sits in the truck bed behind the wheel well, and that I will use that for those moments of like washing your hands at the rest area. And fortunately, the way it is mounted in the truck camper, it faces down. It doesn't come out the side, it faces down. So that will be fairly easy. And as you will hear in the Tale from the Road, I get to put that thing wherever I want. And well, we'll get to that. So do you need a gray tank? Not really, but boy, they're convenient sometimes. I would prefer to have one, but consider they take up a lot of space and they need to be emptied. And honestly, the easiest thing to deal with if you're trying to empty gray water is to just have a jug of gray water that you can drive somewhere or walk somewhere with, rather than having to move your entire rig just to empty gray water. So, just something to think about. That's all. Product review. Now, speaking of gray water, I want to talk specifically about this interesting drain. I've mentioned it before a long time ago. I've had this in 4 different rigs now, and it's the Camco Flexible Camper RV Drain. It's a very interesting drain because it does not have your standard trap. If you look under any sink, especially in the US, you will find what's called a P-trap, and that is the letter P. That is what they mean. And the pipe from the drain goes straight down, and then it curves back up again, and then goes laterally or horizontally away, creating this low point that always has water in it. And that's a stink trap. That's where the word comes from. It's stink trap. It's trapping the stink from the sewers from coming up, because the stink from the sewer can't get through the water. So that's what the P-trap's for. This thing doesn't have that. It's got this weird built-in water trap thing, which is great for vans because it doesn't take up any space. Basically, under your sink, you have this black plastic thing that's about the size of a laundry detergent cap. and there's a hose coming out horizontally from that, and that's it. That horizontal hose can go wherever you want. You can run it to a permanent gray tank, you can run it to a jug that you can remove, or, and the one I have linked in the show notes, runs to something that you can actually drill through the side of your rig and then mount a flange and have that screw knob I've been talking about and do it that way. And they work, and they don't take up much space, and they're very, very good. However, they are very, very susceptible to gravity. And a lot of people install these things and have a serious problem where the water won't drain. And after playing with them, I figured out what the problem is. The problem is that that hose that comes out the side has to go at a down angle. You have to make it go down as soon as you possibly can. Even though it comes out horizontally, it's a flexible hose, and they intend for it to go down as soon as possible. If you have a setup where it runs horizontally for a while, and then you park a little bit off level, that's enough to make the drain either very slow or not work at all. Now, the drain will eventually work. If you fill up the sink high enough, then the water will flow, and then the entire thing will empty because it will suck the water behind it. But that's not convenient. You want all the water to go as soon as you turn on the faucet. So if you get one of these things, and I recommend them, they're very easy and take up very, very little space. They are ideal for van life. Make sure that you run the hose at a down angle as soon as you possibly can to prevent the lock problem. And you can Google about the lock problem. It's very, very common. So it's $20. It's not very expensive. There's a link in the show notes. I've owned several of these, and I think they are a very, very good way to install a drain for your rig. Tales from the road. Okay, let us begin the truck camper tales, or continue them anyway. I finally had some time to spend with my truck camper. I went down and spent a couple days with it. Actually, I spent the first half of it was a 3-day trip. I spent the first 1.5 days working on the truck. Never mind the camper. I installed timbrons, which I've talked about, and I installed wiring so that I could wire the trailer to the truck, which was an adventure, because somewhere along the way, the standard changed, and I had to actually go and manually match what wire went to where, which is fine. So now I have this pigtail cable that is custom to my truck camper and my truck, which I don't like. It has to be plugged in exactly right or it won't work, but, well, since it's only me, that's fine, but I don't understand why there aren't standards for this kind of thing. It makes very little sense to me. I may have just screwed up somewhere, but boy, I was out there with the multimeter for a couple hours trying to wrap my head around it, and I could not figure out what I was doing wrong. Anyway, it works. That's all that counts. And then on to the truck camper after I did that. And the truck camper, and I've made video of this. I will publish a video of some of my work on the truck camper because it's interesting. The video is like this. You go inside the truck camper, and okay, it's 2017. It's 8 years old, and I'll tell you what, it looks really good. You know, there's a couple of scrapes here and there, but it looks great. It looks like a comfy place. It looks like where you want to be. Everything works. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. And then I cut to another video, and I remove the pillows from the bench seats, and then you see my hand going along the bench seats, and with the sound, you hear this kind of noise, and then I form a fist and punch right through the bench seat. My fist goes completely through the bench seat to the outside of the camper. Those things, and they're called wings. They are boards that are on the bottom of the part of the camper that hangs over the sides, where they were so rotten that I was literally able just to push my fingers through and literally punch my fist through. And then I spent the entire day evaluating the damage and determined that on both sides, that whole board needs to be replaced. Now, the good news for me is that I can do that. It's a replaceable board. It doesn't actually have to hold any weight. All it really does is cover up the bottom. And yeah, you sit on it in one part, but it's easily supported enough for that. It's not holding up any of the weight of the trailer. In fact, you could actually go camping in this thing without these parts. You just couldn't sit very easily. Although, now that I think about it, you may have created your own little emergency toilet situation, but let's not go there. So, I'm going to replace these, and I think it's going to be fine. But, why did this happen? And this rig, as I've said, I got it for about half price because I knew there was water damage. And some of it had been repaired. The cab over the truck is all brand new. Someone had repaired that. And that looks pretty solid. I was fortunate enough to be in there during a rainstorm and nothing leaked in. That's all. So I think that's good. But for whatever reason, they didn't fix this part. Where's the water coming from? Now, I bought a water meter, which I will probably review in the future. But it definitely showed that there was water in those wings. This was not old damage. Water was actively getting in there. But there was no water visible. And so using the water meter, I determined that all the water was coming in below the windows, meaning I couldn't find any wet spots above the windows. And so my theory is that these windows were put in with just the foam backing and not the butyl tape they should have been put in with, and the water is getting in behind the windows into the wall where it goes all the way down to the wings and then gets absorbed by the plywood that was there, and over time that has rotted those out. That is what I think happened. The fix for that is, okay, yes, you have to fix the wings, but you also have to fix the leaks. And I'm going to fix them by fixing the windows. I'm going to take the windows out completely, which is a pain in the butt, and then I'm going to butyl tape them and then hopefully install them correctly. And that will be the end of that, I hope. If not, if I'm still going to be fighting leaks, I'm going to take steps to put in a waterproof floor for my wings. And I haven't done this yet, but my plan is to not replace them with the 3/4 ply that was there, but to replace them with boards. This is a little odd, but I'm going to replace them with solid wood planks, like decking, like you'd have on a back deck. Now, I have to be careful of thicknesses and things like that. Deck planks are measured differently than plywood, and I actually have to take a tape measure and make sure they're the same thickness because, you know, for some reason, lumber has these nominal measurements, and a 2x4 is never 2x4 unless it's dimensional lumber, and then it is 2x4. Let's confuse people as much as we possibly can just for tradition's sake, shall we? That apparently is what's going on here. And, deck lumber is measured differently, like 5/4 is a very common thickness of deck lumber. Anyway, that is my plan, and with planks, I'll be able to put them in one at a time and see what I'm doing, and then I will be able to remount all the things I had to take out, such as the gray water drain, and I'll be able to put that closer to the vehicle if I want, which would be easier to have it feed into the bed of the truck for a bucket I have in there or whatever. Also the gas lines, which were a pain in the butt. All truck campers, for some reason, have copper gas lines that run outside of the truck. And on both sides, it's a strange thing. I'm sure there's a reason for it. But why? Why not put the gas lines inside the truck camper? Is it because if they leak, you want them outside? Is that the idea? But when they're outside, they can get beat up. So I'm a little confused by that. But every truck camper I've looked at has been like this. And most truck campers, like mine, they run down both sides of the truck camper, because on mine the stove is on one side and the fridge and tank are on the other side, so they're on both sides. Anyway, I will put those back too. My biggest challenge is the tie downs. So on a truck camper, you have tie downs. They're very important. They're what attach the truck camper to your truck, and they are usually on the corners of the wings. And then they attach either below the truck or with a special mount, whatever. They attach to the truck with chains or something that tightens. Those ripped out of mine. I was able to pull one out with my hand because in this particular truck camper, they were mounted into 1x1s in the corner at the bottom, and they rotted out. And I have to put them back somehow, but I'm not going to put them back in the 1x1s. So what I did was I bought a bunch of heavy-duty D-rings that each have 6 mounting points, and I'm going to bolt them through the planks wherever I feel like it. I bought a whole bunch of them, and I'm like, I'm just going to put a whole bunch, because why not? It's my truck camper. I can put as many as I want there, and I'm going to use those, and I'll be able to tie it down in more than 4 points if I want to. But I'm like, okay, how do you determine how much, you know, weight these things? Like, the truck camper weighs 1,300 pounds empty, and so I, you know, should it be able to hold 1,300 pounds? But wait a minute, I'm not suspending this in the air. It's sitting in the truck. I've got gravity working on my side. But if I go over a big bump, then, you know. So I looked to see what the carrying capacity was of the original tie downs, and it was like 350 pounds. It was like, I'm like, that's hardly anything. So what I'm doing should be way overkill compared to what the camper manufacturer did, and that's what I'm going to do. And folks, I'm going to admit, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just doing what I think makes sense. I am not being a professional in this in any way, shape, or form, but I will share my results with you. You can learn from my mistakes and successes, and I'll let you know how it all goes. But I'm fairly confident this is the right way to go. But I have to say, I've already started to bond with this truck camper a bit. It's a little truck camper, but it looks very big on my truck. It's very tall, and I have an 8-foot bed, and this is like for a 6-foot camper, so I have space behind the back of the camper, which is fine. I can put stuff there. It looks funny, basically, is what I'm saying. Truck campers are not pretty things. I think of all the different styles of campers, truck campers are perhaps aesthetically the least pleasing. But practical? Yeah, this thing's going to be pretty practical, I think. I think this is going to work out. Long term, I know I'm going to have something different, but in the short term, I'm excited about trying this thing, and I can't wait to get it finished. And, I guess that's a tale from the road in progress, but I know some of you have been curious about my truck camper adventures, and, well, I'm deep into it now. A place to visit. I was in London, and I did a walking tour. If you ever go to London, there are all these walking tours that are ridiculously cheap. They're like £20 or something, and you have an expert guide, and they take you to all these unusual places in London. Like, you're not going to go see the normal stuff. You're going to go see the unusual stuff, which to me is interesting stuff. And we did one of these tours of Covent Garden, and one of the places we went was a restaurant, but not to eat, just to tour the restaurant, because it's that interesting. And the restaurant is Rules, just like it sounds, R-U-L-E-S. It is an ancient restaurant. It's the oldest restaurant in London, and all kinds of famous people have eaten here. But it has two things going for it that make it pretty darn cool to me. First off, it's the building itself. It's in this old building in a very touristy part of London. It's a very busy part of London. It's not hidden or anything. But it, you go in there and it looks just like you had stepped into an episode of Downton Abbey or into a James Bond movie. Well, because you have. They're both filmed there. Downton Abbey, when the youngest daughter goes for a job interview, it was in this restaurant. And in Spectre, where Moneypenny and Q track down M while he's eating a meal to tell him that Bond is in trouble or Bond is onto something. Yeah, that was filmed here. I've got more about that in a second. But the restaurant is beautiful. Now, this is a restaurant for people who don't mind eating animals, because this entire place is dedicated to game meats and the hunting thereof. The walls are covered with trophies, lots and lots of antlers and things like that. And if that kind of thing bothers you, this is not the restaurant for you. But it was very much like an English hunt club. And then as you go upstairs, there's a couple of banquet rooms and there is a bar. And then there's like this conservatory upstairs that is like this old kind of English drawing room conservatory with trees and a domed glass roof and couches. And they do this interesting thing where they limit the number of people that are allowed in there. Even though there's seating for like 20 in there, they won't let anyone in after 6 people go in, just to maintain the atmosphere. This place is a stewardship. The people who own this now recognize that they own a piece of history, and it isn't all about making money. They need to make enough money to keep going, obviously, and they do just fine. This is not an inexpensive restaurant, especially the wines are very expensive. But it's not that crazy. I mean, a person of reasonable means can easily have a meal here. I recommend lunch. Now, what I did was, after I did this tour, I thought, wow, this is really cool. And I needed to have a business meeting with some people. Travel business, very, very serious stuff. And I invited them and I said, hey, why don't you meet me for lunch at Rules so we can talk about some things? And two of those people had never been to Rules, so they didn't know what I was talking about. And I called to make the reservations and I said, hey, this is a long shot, but if possible, I would really like to sit at the James Bond table. And if not, I understand. But if we could be in the same room with it in the view, That would be great. I am a big James Bond fan. It's problematic in many, many ways, but it's nostalgia and it's a bit of competency porn and all these things. We can get into that in my own private space, but I just wanted to be in the same room with the Bond stuff. And when we got there, he took me right to the James Bond table, and I was able to sit exactly in the seat that Ray Fine playing M sat in the movie Spectre. And it was a little bit glorious for me. I'm not much of a fanboy, but that was a nice moment to just be able to sit in that scene and take it all in. And now every time I watch that movie, I'll be like, I sat right there and I ate some kind of a steak. I don't even know what it was. The menu is really unusual. Depending on the time of year, they have different kinds of game meats, but even off-season, when they don't have the fresh game meats, they have all kinds of unusual meats. Very, 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 very British menu, and not like a pub menu. They don't have jellied eels and things like that. They have classic British fare, the kind you might find at a British country club in the 1920s, say. I don't know. Anyway, I had a lovely experience there. I loved it. And if you don't want to have a fancy meal in London, which I understand, you're going to spend probably £50 per person no matter what, and easily more than that if you have wine. You can go there on a tour, and you can do the walking tour of Covent Gardens and just see this place, and that alone is worth it. So I'll have a link in the show notes to Rules. I don't have a link for the walking tour, unfortunately, because I was tagging along with somebody else. But this was a really fun, interesting thing to see in London, and if you're into James Bond or Downton Abbey or just like that whole British imperialist thing that was actually completely horrible and terrible and yet is still kind of fun, this is a great place to go. Well, folks, thanks very much for listening to episode 266. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg, and I have to take a time out here and congratulate Simon Wagg on his new job. Simon Wagg is now officially employed in the video game industry, which was his goal for a very long time. He has achieved that goal, and he gets my full praise for that. Good job, sir. Until next time, remember the words of Viktor Frankl, who said, "What is to give light must endure burning."